This program deals with devil worship and satanic beliefs. It contains explicit scenes and descriptions of violent crimes and rituals.
Americans are asking, who attacked our country?
You have declared a subliminal jihad against the United States. Can you tell us why?
Everything pertaining to what's happening has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives.
And night fell on a different world.
And Iblis is thinking, you know, I should be getting this position, not Adam, and this guy is created from dirt.
And how does the army feel about you being head of the Temple of Set?
And the conspiracy theorists can say what they will.
But I want you to give me power over Adam, and I want you to give me soldiers and minions and all of these things.
The people have had so much to gain and had such a material motive for putting me in a position I'm in. We'll never let the true facts come of their voice to the world.
And I want you to be able to give me the ability to whisper into the hearts of mankind.
And who was the Grotto leader?
Don't remember his name.
You don't remember the name of a person who involved you in murder?
Now these people are in very high position, Jack.
Yes.
Welcome back to Subliminal Jihad, episode 187. I'm your co-host, Dimitri.
I'm Khaled.
And today, we're keeping this train rolling, and we're hitting up some more Q&A questions that, let's see. Yeah, from still early 2022, the end of February. So actually, we're syncing up like month-wise, because this will probably come out closer to the end of February. So we're operating on double synchronicity. We're starting with like that synchronicity today, and I think as we already discussed, you know, we're sort of stuck in a time loop. Yeah, I think we had talked about how we're just turning the corner now into the era of Putler's invasion. And
oh yeah, we were discussing yesterday this is the day after the Tucker Putler interview dropped.
Indeed,
we were both very amused by the Tucker Putler interview.
It was very interesting Slavic history lesson.
Yeah,
let's say.
It's very funny.
I think we got some good ones today. Yeah, let's just jump in. I guess I'll read number one.
Sure.
Dot Hogs asked on January 30th, 2022, where isn't sus? I moved from Southern California to Utah, and both places are off the charts with weird shit.
I don't think that there's anywhere that isn't sus. I can't think of anywhere that wouldn't be sus.
At least I kind of assume, since, you know, Southern California and Utah are mentioned, even if we're just kind of limiting this to, it'd be easier maybe for me to point out maybe other parts of the world that are perhaps like not, certainly not as sus as America.
I feel like everywhere has its own susness.
I think you're right. I think there's no place that's truly devoid of it. And just thinking about the United States, like...
Even Antarctica is, like, sus. In fact, Antarctica is, like, really
is.
Sus. Yeah,
of course
so...
it is. Nobody even lives there. And it's, like, Nazis are obsessed with it. And
yeah.
You know. No, I don't think any place really escapes. I was just trying to think about, like, everywhere. I've probably been to most American states, and I've lived in a couple different parts of the country. And, like, maybe some years ago, I would have been like, well, you know, like, I lived in Wisconsin. And then I started talking to Recluse, and I'm like, no, it's us. Dogman lives there. Like, you know,
yeah.
Like, no, it's us. Say with, you know, Massachusetts, where you live, New York, obviously sus, Chicago, sus. Louisiana sus, Florida sus, like
every state,
Tennessee
definitely
sus, Utah
sus.
Definitely sus,
Utah's really
California,
sus,
California extremely sus,
Idaho
Northwest.
Sus,
yeah,
Iowa
exactly,
sus.
Pacific Northwest low key sus, Arizona sus, New Mexico sus, New Age sus, like, but sometimes with like different flavors,
Canada sus, Mexico sus,
absolutely. Yeah, we didn't forget you, Canada. You are definitely sus.
Yeah. Everywhere on Earth and everywhere. In space is sus.
We live on
a
sus planet, in a sus galaxy, in a sus universe. It just is the nature of, you know, I guess living in a place that, you know, that where like good and evil, you know, both coexist, that generates that frisson, you know, generates susness and also, you know, mystery. Like, because every place in the world has its like mysterious dimension or element or something, you know. Whether it's preserved in folklore or it's like certain natural things or whatever. I would try to think like, yeah, what's like the absolute least sus place I could move in like the United States. If I really just wanted to, you know, if things just got too hot, you know, like in LA, it had to really like go off the grid. I mean, I guess if you're by yourself, like the Unabomber out in like a cabin in the middle of nowhere,
the like, woods are sus then, though. Nature,
even if nobody's
like,
around, then you're
sus
because you live it's out like, in the woods like that. I don't know.
Like, and there's like, you know, cryptids and djinn stuff out there. And,
exactly.
You know, who knows? Yeah. Yeah.
Bigfoot.
Bigfoot, like weird, you know, like feral people in national parks. You know,
like
we
black helicopter teams.
Not to credit that, you know, but as you can hear our discussion of that in the Missing 411 episode. But yeah, still, there's like some sus stuff going on up in the middle of nowhere. Definitely. The middle of nowhere is pretty sus, too. Yeah, I'm trying to think like, you know, it's like there's like some boring small towns, you know, but also like I feel like you could easily run across something sus there, even if the stakes aren't like cosmically high.
Yeah,
like some there's susness to be found. I mean, like,
think of
would
a,
that
a
be
mild...
a sus as LA? Maybe it's hard to say like, you know, oh, this is a sus as LA, but, you know, is San Jose as sus as LA? Probably not, but
yeah.
Sometimes
well,
it's not sus.
They're sus in very different ways. I think San Jose always sussed me out as a Bay Area. I feel like a lot of people in the Bay Area feel that way, like particularly probably in the East Bay, but I'm sure people in like the on the peninsula also like San Jose, it's the biggest city still in the Bay Area, but it is like the least swagged out city. No offense to anybody who lives in San Jose, but you probably know what I mean. It just doesn't have the swag that like San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, and even some of the other kind of towns and stuff. And it's like huge association with like tech. Actually, no, because the headquarters, wait a minute, the headquarters, I think, of one of the Rosicrucian orders in America is in San Jose and has been since like,
well,
I think,
I was never saying
years.
That it's not sus, but
no,
is it
right,
as sus
right.
as LA?
Well, no, now I'm entertaining this concept. Is it? I mean, LA is very sus. So, to say that it's not as sus as LA is not to say it isn't sus. Like, you know, it could still be very sus, but LA is like a really high bar to, there's so much lore here, you know, I mean, between the entertainment industry, the aerospace industry and spiritualism and like cults and culture and stuff like that. Like, and all like the billionaires that live here. It's very, but you know, actually San Jose also, or one of the communities like adjacent to San Jose, has a very spooky place that we've, I think, mentioned before, the Winchester Mystery House, which is now an attraction that, like, you could take, like, little kids to, but is, like, the insane, sprawling, like, mansion of, I think, Sarah Winchester, who is the widow of the silk topper, you know, rifle maker Winchester, who I think probably through, like, some kind of dabbling in spiritualism or something, came to believe that she was being haunted by all the ghosts of all the dead soldiers that like her husband's rifles had killed in the Civil War. And somehow she got the idea that if she kept building wings to her house, that like, the way I was told when I was a kid was that she thought she would never die if she kept adding additions to her house. So it's very creepy.
The way I heard it, like, was that she wanted to confuse the ghosts, like they wouldn't catch her.
Oh, okay,
you know?
Okay. Because there's like staircases that go to nowhere and stuff like that all around the house. Like,
exactly, so the ghosts would like go up the stairs, but they get confused.
Yeah. So a lot of early California silk toppers lived, I think, down in that kind of San Jose area. And that's why like that mansion is down there. And obviously, I think, what is it? You know, Menlo Park, Atherton, that kind of Stanford area also that's where Stanford like built, Leland Stanford built his like farm, you know, that was like his estate that turned into the university. So down, it's a sus node down there, like, cause it's so Silicon Valley adjacent, but you know, they're both pretty sus in like their own ways. I think here's the thing about the Bay, like, I think it's a little bit of a mismatch to like compare like San Jose and Los Angeles, because Los Angeles is like, it really is kind of referring to like Los Angeles County. It's like a huge sprawling metropolitan area. So it's more comparable to compare the Bay Area with quote unquote Los Angeles, which like would include like Pasadena, Santa Monica, the Valley, like the Laurel Canyon, you know, all that kind of shit, like down to South Central, Long Beach, Port City, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, these are big geographical areas that have like micro nodes of extreme susness, like dotted throughout their landscapes. And I mean, California, very sus. Utah also. I mean, I've been to Utah. I've only been to Utah once a few years ago. Like I drove there on a road trip and never been to Salt Lake City. But I think when I was going to Zion National Park, so I think I stopped in St. George, Utah, which is like, I guess, kind of a medium-ish size city, and a couple other places. Also went to Colorado City, Arizona / Hilldale, Utah, which was the extremely remote town that was taken over by the FLDS, like Warren Jeffs people.
Mm-hmm.
That was a fun before SJ, kind of a proto SJ like investigation thing of like going to the town where it's like his fall. I mean, he's been arrested. A lot of his followers finally got like driven out of it a couple in the late like 2010s, but there's still clearly like some of them living there. And, you know, I might have mentioned this before. There's a sus airport there that was built with like millions of dollars in federal money during the presidency of George H.W. Bush. And there was a lot of stuff about how like Warren Jeffs would take his little private jets and like traffic girls from his cult, like to Las Vegas and elsewhere using that airport. And I just got big Barry Seal vibes from all of it. Right. And I remember when I went there, I was filming it and it was like just at sunset and it's like a tiny little building in the middle of nowhere in this town that takes like an hour to drive to from like the closest small city, like really in the middle of nowhere. And I must have only been there about a minute and like this black Chevy like Suburban just like emerges over the horizon. Like I don't even know where it came from. And it was just like driving straight towards us, like very intently. They were like, okay, let's get the fuck out of here. And then like hightailed it out of there. They didn't really chase us, but it was creepy. It's like there's still, I'd read stories of like when people went there when the cult was still active, like you would get black Suburbans like following you around with like Mormon dudes being like, what are you doing here? Like, where you, like they know you're not from around there kind of thing and all that kind of shit. So Utah definitely, I mean, I think we got to get, we've been meaning to have Jimmy Falun Gong from Program to Chill back on, I think for what would be his third appearance on SJ, to specifically talk about some like sus Utah issues.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting shit with Utah, but in terms of what isn't, I'm coming up short. Like name me any part of the United States and I will point out at least like one sus aspect of it.
Yeah. Oh, yes, certainly.
Well, okay. All right. Yeah. I guess that's it. We have nowhere. That's the answer.
Yeah, nowhere. The answer is nowhere. There's only places that are like relatively less sus, but you won't find a place that isn't sus.
No. And we all should just like get used to it and learn to live with that because instead of trying to like, you know, get precious about saying that certain things aren't sus and like getting really like butthurt about it.
Yeah.
And,
just because you're pointing out something is sus doesn't mean that you're saying only that thing is sus. There's lots of sus things.
Yeah. Yeah. We just want to like, you know, make susness visible. Like, Tony 2012.
Shine a light on it.
And, and then the more you shine a light, the less spooky it is. You know, it's fine, and everyone can celebrate their own local susness. You know, it's not just concentrated in
Celebrate susness.
Yeah, celebrate your susness. Like coexist, like coexist bumper sticker. Like celebrate susness.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of ironic, given our like overall opposition to susness. Like we're not. I guess it would be doing an irony to print out those bumper stickers, right?
Yes.
It celebrates that.
I wouldn't
really
say that
saying,
you should. Yeah.
No,
you should
no.
Celebrate susness. I mean, there's different types of susness, I think. There's different varieties. Like, there's different ways to be, like, suspect. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it's a very, I think it's a usefully malleable term. You know,
it certainly is malleable. It's certainly broadly applicable. I think if the podcast has proved nothing else, it's the versatility of the word sus.
just fits so well. You gotta use
I mean, it really does. Like, it's like really the best way to describe like a lot of things. Like, it's really the best way to describe, like, because it's better than suspicious, because I feel like it's a little bit softer.
Yeah, suspicious, you know? Is more like, specific.
Like, yeah, like you wouldn't, you know, necessarily. I mean, usually, like, there are synonyms, but there are some cases where something's, like, sus, but it's, like, even vaguer than suspicious, you know? Like,
yeah, like, somebody acting sus might not be acting suspicious. That's more, like, I think of somebody, like, sneaking around, like, being shifty, like, sneaking around, like, being, like, being very overtly, like, kind of sneaky, sinister, or something like that. But like a sus person is like, you know, like an MK Ultra, like New Age guru, who's like love and like some Ram Dass ass motherfucker, like Tim Leary, who's always like bubbly and like goofy and positive.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, how like people sus. You can even actually be sus when like everyone knows exactly what's up with you, and like we just don't like it. That's like still sus. Like, it's not like, you know, there's any like ambiguity here, like that is caused from like suspicion. It's just, yeah, they're just, it's just sus.
That's true too. I mean, you can call somebody sus like with full verification, I guess.
Yeah, like everyone could agree they're sus, you know. Like,
it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily, it can mean a question mark of like, maybe this person's kind of like not on the level. But it also can just be a straight declarative statement of like,
it's like, you know, there's also like a subjective component. Like, if you're sussed out by something, it doesn't necessarily mean the thing is fundamentally like objectively sus.
You know? You're just talking about your lived experience.
You can be, yeah, exactly. You know, you can be sussed out like by one thing that might not suss out others, and like that's valid.
It's valid. Being sussed out is valid.
Being sussed out is very valid.
We never try to, you know, talk down to people or say they can't be sussed out. Like, they're not allowed to be sussed out.
True. We definitely don't ever. I don't think that we've ever said that you're not allowed to be sussed out. That's the opposite.
In fact, if people have
gotten mad at us for like trying to, you know, not let them enjoy things, it's because like, you know, they felt that we weren't allowing them to not be sussed out. But it's fine. If you're not sussed out, that's okay. You don't have to live in a world of susness, you know, if you just want to ignore it. Although, but we think you should embrace it, I guess, or recognize it.
Yeah. No, it's fair. It's fair. I'm sure people, there's certain things we like that, you know, people think are sus, and you know, you
just like Islam people.
Yeah, like believing in like not liking Satanism.
it's really sus. Some people think that's like
sus. Some people literally think that's sus, that we, you know, that we like must be up to something, because like, why do they speak negatively about like Satanism all the time? Like,
being a white convert is sus, but I admit that's sus.
That's
white
true.
Converts We've are talked, sus.
We did a whole episode about a sus white convert and talked about the
that's
phenomenon.
That's really just the tip of the iceberg too. There's so many, like we were just talking about Haronia, like he's also sus.
Oh yeah.
So.
Well, okay. Well,
he's more of a nominal, you know, but. And it's a little
Of, this is actually a really good segue, because like, speaking of kind of applying the sus heuristic, do you want to read number two? Because I think we got a really good candidate here.
Yeah, Latif asks on 2/9/2022. Any thoughts? Wow, interesting, because we're actually like, this is exactly 2 years ago.
Any thoughts
on the Thelemite magician, folklorist, filmmaker Harry Smith? The man who allegedly gave birth to the folk revival of the 1960s through the American Anthology of Folk Music. When receiving a Grammy, he emoted, "I've lived to see my dream come true. I've seen the world change through music. It's different post-Begowan." Okay. I have not like really looked into this guy. Honestly, I'm like not super aware of like Harry E. Smith or like his like susness. His parents were both theosophists.
Oh yeah, no, I read into a couple articles. I wasn't really familiar with him either, but then I was kind of shocked that we hadn't stumbled upon. Maybe we had, and it's like the curse of having the last name Smith is you just kind of like forget about people like that have like overly common names like that. But this guy, I mean, it doesn't jump out at you like Kenneth Anger, you know?
Yeah,
who he admired and was like friends with, and a fellow Thelemite. But I read a few things about him. He actually just had, I think, a retrospective in 2023. I don't know if I think it was in New York. I forget if it was at MoMA or somewhere else, but there was just an article, I think, on artreview.com from October of this last year called What to Make of Harry Smith. But he this guy hits a lot of like the SJ bingo spots of like just a huge sus lord. Like this guy's up in kind of like Del Close territory and is friends with, you know, a lot of sus lords we've talked about before, like Allen Ginsberg. I mean, basically, yeah, he has kind of a crazy biography. Let me just pull up his little Wikipedia here. So, okay, he was an artist, experimental filmmaker, a bohemian, mystic, record collector, hoarder, student of anthropology, and a neo-Gnostic bishop in the, let's see, Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica, which is basically the ecclesiastical arm of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, you know, Aleister Crowley's infamous Thelemite, you know, organization. So this guy, like you said, he was born in Oregon and he was raised by like devout theosophists. So there we go again. Like I'm not even surprised anymore that, you know, that that tends to be the common lineage. I think we've definitely seen a pattern emerging of people that got into like 1950s and 60s kind of new agey stuff that, that bled into like Esalen Institute, et cetera, MK Ultra adjacent things. Like so many people came from a kind of para-theosophical background, right? Even though theosophy itself as a thing seemed to kind of fall off by like the mid 20th century, but like its influence is everywhere, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah, like theosophy itself, you're right, like became significantly less popular. Like that, you'll run a few people who are like, I'm a theosophist, or like who are going, you know, theosophy centers like are, you know, less hubs than they were. But their influence absolutely like runs through like so many occult discourses today.
Yeah. So they were, his parents were theosophists with pantheistic tendencies involving the belief in an immanent God who is identical with the universe or nature. And I guess he also, like, he grew up around a lot of folk music and also near the Swinomish Indian Reservation in Washington, I guess, where he ended up getting raised, like, kind of near Seattle. And I had, the only thing I had heard about with this guy is the anthology of folk music. I definitely had heard of that. I always thought that was like kind of like the WPA, like Smithsonian Institute
I
thing
did too.
That was very
I
official.
I guess not. Yeah. I mean, I'm like into Smithsonian folk ways. Like I like a lot of those recordings, but.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I guess I like it. His Wikipedia. That I like that sus.
It looks like his Wikipedia picture of him in 1965 looking very much like a hippie beatnik freak. It cuts out his one of his hands, but it looks like he's doing like the up down like Baphomet like pose, basically.
Yeah, true.
This guy was a serious Thelemite.
I guess Folkways Records started out being founded by Moses Ash. It was like some dude, but it was acquired by the Smithsonian.
But Harry Smith brought his collection of records to him. So
yeah.
So he was really, I mean, I guess he just was collecting all of these early commercial records, like many of them. What was the name of like the shitty types of records that used to get made? I'm forgetting, but a lot of them are like melted down during World War II, like for raw materials or something. And so he would like stow a bunch of them away for years and like obsessively kind of like hoard and collect all these different ones. And then I guess he like cataloged all of them, and then eventually, like when he was like broke and needed money, he went and what was it, Moshe? I'm forgetting his last name. Moses Ash. Yeah. He approached him with this whole collection, and then he put it out, and then I guess it was acquired by the Smithsonian. But I didn't realize that. Like, also, I think I read a couple articles, one of which mentioned that, like, this was basically like an occult working, like disguised as like a music collection, something along those lines. There was like a kind of a chilling quote like that.
Well, yeah, they both have like an alchemical like sigil as their cover art, basically. The celestial monochord in Harry Smith's terms, which is taken from a mystical treatise by Robert Flood.
That's right. And apparently, like, the impact of this, so, you know, I have heard of it because it introduced, like, a lot of young people, you know, especially young people, like the young boomers, to all of this folk music that ended up being, like, incredibly influential in the 1960s. You know, people like Bob Dylan, who I think we're going to get to in a second, and another question. But, yeah, I'm reading this article in Art Review that was, like, from, you know, a few months ago. It talks about, yeah, it says, if you've never heard of Harry Smith, perhaps the most obvious entry point is Anthology of American Folk Music, released in 1952. This six-album collection of 84 blues, folk, country, and gospel records was drawn from the then 29-year-old Oregon-born Smith's own obsessive, itinerant, and effortful stockpiling of obscure and out-of-print commercial 78s. Mo Ash of Folkways Records convinced Smith to compile the album after the latter came to him, characteristically broke, attempting to hawk his collection for cash. Anthology's release was hugely catalytic. It led directly to the folk revival in 1950s America, thence to young people listening to politicized lyrics. From here, one can argue, as Allen Ginsberg has, that it led to a raising of political consciousness and the explosion of the counterculture. Indeed, Smith himself claimed to expect as much. Quote, I felt social changes would result, he stated succinctly in 1968. This might seem presumptuous, but Smith was nothing if not an egomaniac. But note that the cover of Anthology, which features an illustration from a book on mysticism by Elizabethan-era English physician and occultist Robert Flood, of a musical instrument called a celestial monochord being tuned by the hand of God. Its three double albums are color-coded red, green, and blue to reference the dynamic elements, fire, water, air, and the songs themselves were dispatches from a fog-bound lost world full of ghosts, murders, and spooky cockeyed meanings due to folk lyrics changing over time. Anthology music critic Grile Marcus wrote, when the records were reissued during the 1990s, was, quote, an occult document disguised as an academic treatise on stylistic shifts within an archaic musicology. It testified in its very packaging not only to the various levels on which its compiler was thinking and working, but also to the cosmic power of culture. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so yeah, I mean, so it was an occult document disguised as an academic treatise on stylistic shifts within an archaic musicology. So, yeah, I mean, if you look up the cover of it, it might not seem that kind of, oh, super occulty, but it is kind of this...
It looks pretty occulty. I could see you, like, not necessarily recognizing this, like, if you thought maybe it was some kind of musical diagram, which... But, I mean, this is a weird illustration for, like, a folk... like compilation record of like bootlegs, you know?
Yeah, it's like subtle, like, enough that you wouldn't.
It's very John,
like,
D.
Yeah.
I guess, like, it's Robert Flood-esque, but
Robert Flood. And I guess it's hard for me to tell because a lot of them have like Smithsonian recordings like written on them. Like I want to see exactly what it looked like when it first came out, because maybe it's like a slightly different rendering. But I think I'm looking at like the right one of kind of this the strange celestial instrument. I don't know. It is interesting. And then this went on, like, these records, I think they went on definitely, like, were an influence on Bob Dylan, also big influence on Jerry Garcia, back, who, you know, kind of came, so many people came out of if they were old enough to be doing music in, like, the early 60s, you know, the real hip thing to do was to do, like, folk music, right? And then kind of to get a little more like it, they're like, okay, Ginsberg, like he's not necessarily wrong about that, that just like the discovery of this kind of like folk tradition stimulated a lot of like creativity in like rock and roll and singer songwriters and things like that, that had a huge thing of unpopular music. I just want to read a little more from, actually, this is from Miami Rail, an older article. Let's see. I don't know what year this is from, but it's called I'm Harry Smith and I Hate You. That's a quote from Harry Smith.
Okay.
And they say, we're going to get a lot of pings on the name list, the sus name list here. So they say that as stories surrounding Harry Smith, 1923 to 1991, are the stuff of legend. He was a painter, filmmaker, anthropologist, ethnomusicologist, archivist, and alchemist ordained in the Ordo Templi Orientis, founded by occult magus Aleister Crowley. He was also a slight, disheveled, cantankerous genius with poor eyesight and a lifelong relationship with alcohol, marijuana, speed, esoteric books, and filmmaking. He was known to spend years working on a single labor-intensive film only to unspool it down Second Avenue in New York's Lower East Side in an alcohol-fueled temper tantrum. Artworks and collections have been given away or lost as he was evicted from various hotel apartments he inhabited during the decades he lived in New York. He survived by selling, trading, and bartering his artwork for food and rent. Toward the end of his life, Smith was the, quote, shaman in residence at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, founded by
that's
Tibetan...
something.
Right? I mean...
that's something that's fundamental. It's, it reminds me of Del Close's, like, house metaphysician at SNL job. Anyone who's, like, the, yeah. like, metaphysician or shaman or guru in residence anywhere is sus.
I mean, this guy, his whole bio gives me such Del Close vibes, like, because he was kind of this, like, scruffy weirdo who's fucked up all the time, but, like, he did attract a certain, like, following or crowd or had interesting people, and he had a lot of lore that he would, like, lie about, and, you know, basically, it was hard to tell, like, what his real deal was, and, of course, he was very into the occult. But anyways, so... the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, was founded by Tibetan meditation master and teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So I don't know what I don't know his specific vibe or where he sits in the hierarchy of like Tibetan Buddhism, but we've already talked about, I mean, we've talked about the Dalai Lama being sus, and there were some other Rinpoches that were. Yeah, let me see. He's a master. He's from Tibet. He was the 11th of the Trungpa Tulkus. There's like little umlauts and stuff on this, so I apologize for mangling it.
A person is a discoverer of ancient hidden texts or terma. Okay. They're considered to be incarnations of the 25 main disciples of the Padmasambhava, who foresaw a dark time in Tibet. Okay.
He coined the term crazy wisdom. Interesting.
Okay.
Some of his teaching methods and actions, particularly his heavy drinking, womanizing, and the physical assault of a student and his wife, caused controversy during his lifetime and afterward. Cool. Okay. All right. Yeah. So very ascended master. Known for Shambhala training, I guess, is like his specific approach. And of course, like founded a sus institute in Colorado. I read it's different
article. It's
amazing
like what you can get away with, like if you're like a spiritual person, like in the 60s, you know, like if you're like had this sort of like aura of like authentic spiritual wisdom, like in 1963, with the assistance of sympathetic Westerners, Trungpa received a Spalding sponsorship to spend time at Oxford and was granted common room access to St. Anthony's College, Oxford University. So he basically got like, you know, all these great resources.
Very
just
sus.
Like for, you know, for nothing, like for, you know, being
like
prophesied to
bring
Dharma
upon
to
by
the West.
British Empire.
Yeah.
Interesting. Also, I think I read in another article that he said that I'm pretty sure Allen Ginsberg got him that job at the Jack Kerouac School of like disembodied what the fuck metaphysics.
I guess he did climb 19,000 feet over the Himalayas allegedly in order to
just like Crowley. Did any of his companions die?
It wasn't a recreational thing. It was, you know, to like get away from the PLA, I guess.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Harry Smith.
No.
Okay. This is Trungpa, right?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Trungpa.
Trungpa, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Trungpa. Yeah, I think Allen Ginsberg got him the job at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, the tortured poets department at the Naropa Institute. That's what it's called, right?
The tortured poets department? Yeah.
All right.
That's their new album. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, yeah. That Taylor's Super Bowl is coming up this weekend. So
yeah.
We'll see how powerful her spiritual riz is.
I think she's going to ensure a Chiefs victory. I think
it's gonna happen.
I think she's powerful
and if
enough
not,
to
like,
just will a Chiefs victory.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'll
be scary. This is another very important, the last line here. At the Naropa Institute, Harry Smith taught classes on alchemy, Native American cosmologies, and the rationality of namelessness, and was supported by a grant provided to him by the Grateful Dead organization. So literally, like, his
is
like
a grant from the Grateful Dead organization.
That's so a grant from the Great. And this is back in like the '80s. This is like not like Dead and Company today. This is like back when Jerry was still alive and stuff. But I guess Jerry was such a big fan of this dude that like the Grateful Dead organization, I guess they were rolling in enough cash by the late '80s that they could just like sponsor his professor chair at the Sus-Naropa Institute. Very cool. So, you know, this guy so far is really kind of a hitting. Here's another thing about him, like kind of lying and doing irony about his background. Harry Smith claimed to be either the lost son of Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna, the daughter of the last Russian Tsar who escaped assassination during the Russian Revolution, or the orphan of British occultist Aleister Crowley, depending on who he was talking to. Public records indicate he was actually born in Portland, Oregon. He was brought up in the Pacific Northwest by parents who were practicing theosophists. He became interested in anthropology, music, and art in an early age. The Wakiyotl, Lummi, and Samish American Indian cultures permeated this region of the U.S., and by the age of 15, he had already begun recording their songs and rituals and gained fluency in their spoken languages. Okay. Did he? Like, that sounds like something you could maybe lie about. But
that
okay.
That doesn't sound true.
It doesn't sound true.
Yeah.
So I guess he befriended Native Americans who in 1964 invited him to record their songs and rituals, released by Folkways Records as a 3LP box set, The Kiowa Peyote Meeting. Okay, so obviously peyote is involved, 1973. And he did a lot of like experimental early films. Like very, very kind of like Kenneth Anger type stuff, but like you kind of working with different symbolism. He was awarded one of the first Guggenheim fellowships, which he used to relocate to New York's infamous Chelsea Hotel in 1951. And I guess he just hoarded all of these like collections of like old things, pop-up books, esoteric literature, tarot cards, Ukrainian painted eggs. It's interesting that like a couple articles like specify like he was all about collecting Ukrainian painted eggs, but I don't know if he's talking about kind of the, you know, 'cause that's a Russian thing too. Like the decorated eggs, you know, that you can see. We saw some
like
painted
Fabergé eggs. Yeah.
At the, Fabergé eggs at the, I think we saw it at the Kremlin when we were, you know, there to get our orders. When we were visiting there many years ago. So it's interesting in the context of like the Cold War that, and also stuff we've talked about with like Ukrainian occultism, that he's like all about Ukrainian painted eggs. Like it's just, it's very specific, right? And then also he would like lie and tell people that he was like the son of Anastasia. Like
his mom like believed that she was like the Tsarina of Russia. Right?
Oh, really? His mom actually thought that?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it was like a reincarnation thing or like if she was, I don't know, insane, but it might have been some kind of like theosophical like transmigration of the spirit or something.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe she actually thought she was Anastasia. I don't know.
It's
I guess the Fabergé egg thing is different from the painted
egg.
Eggs.
Okay, that's a specific like Ukrainian.
That's
like folk tradition.
I guess
tradition.
So. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Interesting. Yeah. So,
well, as we know from Putler himself, you know, Ukraine just means like border of Russia, and it's all Poland and Lenin's fault.
This is all part of the Polonization psyop.
Yes.
I mean,
explain yourself. Why have the Polish people been responsible for all the suffering?
Well, you know, they simultaneously were working with Hitler, but then they were stubborn like they always are and refused to give up Gdynia or, you know, Gdansk.
Exactly.
Or Danzig.
Forcing Hitler to invade them.
Forcing Hitler to
Polish
invade.
Polish stubbornness. Yeah.
And also threatened to shoot down all the Soviet planes to like help Czechoslovakia. You know,
but I digress.
No, I'm not here to like defend Polish, but okay,
yeah,
you know,
I guess like this Kiowa Peyote album, it seems like it was like the Native American, it was like people involved with the Native American church, you know, like it wasn't necessarily like super, I don't know, like ancient traditional like Kiowa rituals or something.
This is more of a new
it was like
age-y
his Native
adjacent.
American, like it's, you know, you've ever heard of the Native American church. It's like kind of like a syncretic thing.
Were they the ones that had the Supreme Court case that like got peyote sort of legalized under religious exemptions.
Yes.
There was that. Okay. I think that I have heard of them. Yeah. And that was a significant case for like psychedelic legalization.
Yeah.
They were the first to do
it. And there's also like now the Neo American Church, which, you know, has tried similar things in terms of like claiming drugs as sacraments.
Oh, I mean, now there's like thousands of like fly by night ayahuasca churches that kind of operate in a gray area and do that. And it's like the easiest loophole to drive through is to be like, for ones that do like ceremonies, like it,
yeah,
like they'd be like, well, we're not actually a church or a cult, but like you just have to sign this thing that like says you're like a follower of our church and blah, blah, blah. So it's legal, you know, things like that. I just want to read this little, this is a jam-packed little segment of like his bio overview here. In the late 1940s in California, Smith is said to have worked with Charles Stansfeld Jones, the one-time acolyte of Ipsissimus Crowley. Smith would later study under Jones's quote trusted student Albert Handel in New York. Smith frequented the Samuel Weiser Antiquarian Bookstore, a used bookstore in New York's Book Row that specialized in works on comparative religion, hermeticism, and the occult. The store's publishing house, Weiser Books, used Smith's designs for its paperback edition of Aleister Crowley's Holy Books of Thelema. Ed Sanders recounts that Smith was the key advisor for Allen Ginsberg and the Fugs' effort to levitate the Pentagon. Remember that? We've talked about that before.
Yeah, we have.
So he was the key advisor of this like weird occult ritual thing that was like a Vietnam protest. So I guess Sanders wrote that in the fall of 1967, a bunch of us decided to exorcise the demons from the Pentagon as part of a big demonstration against the Vietnam War. I was in charge of coming up with a structure for the exorcism. I knew Harry would know what to do, so I conferred with him. He gave me the basic outline, which was to use the symbols of the four directions and to use the symbols of earth, air, fire, and water. He also suggested adding a cow to represent the goddess Hathor. Okay. We did have a cow prepared, painted with mythic symbols.
Don't have a cow, man.
They do have a cow. But the police stopped it from getting near the Pentagon. The exorcism was duly recorded by WBAI's Bob Foss, who I believe we talked about in our Pacifica episode, because WBAI, you know, was one of the Pacifica radio stations, right, in New York. So they were on the ground documenting this epic ritual. Interesting. And I think, wasn't Bob Foss like with a proto, like, I'm gonna fart into the mic, like, Bob Foss. Yeah,
like, you're not talking about Bob Fosse, the dancer, are you?
F-A-S-S.
Oh, okay.
I know that name came up in the book we read about Pacifica Radio. And there were a couple of hosts that almost were doing like a proto like dirtbag shock jock thing. And I think he was like one of the main people. Yeah. Radio Unnameable was his program. Yeah. Cool. He started working at WBAI in 1963. He had the Midnight to Dawn time block. His signature greeting, "Good morning, Cabal," came from a listener. I wanted a sign online. Like,
wow,
William,
that's like
B.
the original
Williams,
last
morning,
podcast.
World. Yeah.
The original last podcast on the left.
Good night and hail Satan.
Hail yourself and Satan, or, you know. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So the show is a freeform show, often with random phone calls and political discussion. This is definitely what I was referring to. Yes. Jay Sand wrote that nowhere else could you hear a DJ playing two records at the same time or backwards or the same song over and over and over again simply because he liked its message. Nowhere else in the early 60s could you hear callers and hosts alike criticize LBJ for escalating the war in Vietnam, encourage men to burn their draft cards, or talk in glowing terms about their drug experiences. Radio Unnameable was a counterculture radio show before anyone ever applied the term to America's dropout youth. This Bob Fass was a hippie before there were hippies.
Cool.
Sounds like he was a freak.
This is awesome.
Then Faz collaborated with Gerd Stern and Michael Callahan's. Interesting. Media collective USCO.
No relation.
I have to check the spell. Interesting. Bookmark that for later.
Is it spelled the same?
Let me just scratch that itch real quick. No. It's C-A-L-L-A-H-A-N. Okay. So, well, you know, you can always drop a You can do like a Donald Werby kind of thing. But anyways, he collaborated with this media collective, USCO, which interesting, an acronym for Us Company or the Company of Us, like U.S. company slang for the CIA, most active during the years 1964-66, which produced sound fields for Timothy Leary's Fillmore East shows, then dove in and began creating mixes in the air. In the mid-1970s, Fass asked the station's chief engineer, Mike Edel, if there was any way to rig up a contraption that would allow Fass to put as many as 10 phone calls on the air at the same time. The system Edel built became a centerpiece of Fass's show, allowing more of his listeners to connect with him and with each other. Wow. He's been called a midwife at the birth of the counterculture. Oh, this is funny here. It says he plays a major role in Mark Fisher's book, Something in the Air. And I'm like, what? Like Mark Fisher, but it's like a different Mark Fisher, like M-A-R-C, who's like a Washington Post writer. That would have been funny if he invited the, quote, cabal to join him for the fly-in, a get-together at JFK Airport, where he and his friends could meet and party with radio unnameable listeners and their friends while aircraft took off. This is his first podcast live show ever. Wow. Very cutting edge. Anyways, kind of like gone off on a thing here. But yeah, then like he was involved with the Yippies and all that other, and Ed Sanders. I think the Fugs, I think that Harry Smith was like very instrumental in like recording the Fugs music, like Ed Sanders' band, you know, very like sarcastic, like punk, like kind of proto-punk, like beatnik, hippie, whatever. So, okay, interesting. So, wait, I forgot how he was even connected to, that's what it was. Bob Fass, that was down at like the like ritual levitation of the Pentagon, like recording all of it. And then his recording ended up on the Fugs album, Tenderness Junction. And Harry Smith was like the chief advisor. Okay, we're in this counterculture soup, obviously. It's like he's working with all these big people and certain weird scenes that we've examined before. Just going on here, Harry Smith also studied the Enochian system in depth, and as it was recounted by Edward Kelly and John Dee, which was later elaborated on by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and the aforementioned OTO. He compiled a concordance of the Enochian language with the aid of Kem Kagan, his assistant throughout much of the 1970s and early 80s. In 1986, Smith was consecrated a bishop in the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica, an order which claims William Blake and Giordano Bruno in its pantheon of saints. Smith was long a familiar figure in the New York branch of the OTO. In 2023, Smith was accorded a very rare honor of being canonized a Gnostic saint in the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica by Hymenaeus Beta, the head of the EGC. Wow. Hymenaeus Beta canonized him. So he is like, he is a Thelemite saint. I don't even think Kenneth Anger got that high.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. I mean,
I'm reading an incredibly juicy book called The Great Naropa Poetry Wars. Harry Smith isn't in it, but Trungpa is like the central figure of it. There's like it's really, really juicy. Okay, let me just read some of this. So this is the Naropa Institute, founded in Boulder in 1974. The institute was formed by Chungyam Trungpa as a nonprofit educational institution subsidiary to the Nalanda Foundation, a quote-unquote secular wing of the Vajradhatu. While legally distinct, Naropa and Vajradhatu maintained common officers and boards of directors. Trungpa's directors and officers included several men with excellent minds for law and business. The careful division of Trungpa's holdings into separate corporate entities served at least two important purposes. Tax money could be saved, and the reputation of Naropa as a civilian institution could be protected by the, quote, watertight compartment argument and appeal to original corporate legal divisions. Trungpa's own stated plans for Naropa makes it clear the school was never meant to be secular at all. The purpose of Naropa, he proclaimed, is first of all to provide a vessel for the development of bodhisattva activity. Loyalists in the administration, who make up the whole administration, have in recent years argued with Naropa faculty over require Buddhist sitting discipline in the new degree programs. The outcome of this struggle is still in doubt, but the fact that it's even going on invalidates Naropa's claims to secular status. Daily sitting meditation, says the current Naropa catalog, is highly encouraged for all students. 6 credits of study in a meditative discipline is a BA requirement. An Europa student once interrupted Trungpa during a crazy wisdom lecture called The Blue Pancake, which is about having the sky fall on your head. "What's so hot about having a pancake fall in your head?" the student asked. "Well," replied Trungpa, laughing, "I think it is a big joke, a big message." Crazy wisdom-wise, Naropa has always been a big joke, like Trungpa's blue pancake. Before looking into the circumstances of its founding, let's briefly consider 2 prior episodes that occurred in the Trungpa scene in Boulder. They will help us understand Trungpa better. The first was a benefit poetry reading for Trungpa's Karma Zong Meditation Center held at Mackey Auditorium on the University of Colorado campus, May 6, 1972. Poets on hand included Ginsberg, Robert Bly, and Gary Snyder. Trungpa, acting as a self-appointed MC, was in his cups. During the reading, he upstaged the poets with his humorous antics, and at the end, he apologized for the poets in a muddled, patronizing speech. "I'm sure they don't mean what they said." The evening ended with Trungpa drunk and truculent, yelling and beating on a big gong. "If you think I'm doing this because I'm drunk," Trungpa told Ginsberg during the evening, "you're making a big mistake." Ginsberg, already had a great admirer of the young Tibetan master, was genuinely puzzled. "Is this just you?" he asked. "Or is this a traditional manner, or what?" "I come from a long line of eccentric Buddhists," the 11th Trungpa explained. So this guy like died of like cirrhosis of the liver. Like, he's just a huge alcoholic. God, but anyway, damn, wow. Ginsberg subsequently defended Trungpa for taking over the poetry reading. But Gary Snyder, a longtime student of Zen, and Robert Bly, once a crazy wisdom disciple at Sam Yeling, were offended by Trungpa's behavior. Bly, as it was to turn out, quite seriously. The Mackey Auditorium incident adduces the tension that already existed between Trungpa, the spiritual king, and those secular artists he envisages as his laureates. Of this, more later. By this time, Trungpa's claim to authority over his students' personal lives had increased dramatically. Privacy, when applied to the students, had become a dirty word like ego.
Oh,
the guru
here we go.
Warned them
here
that
go.
By themselves, they could never wash the sticky glue of karma out of their hair. "Let me mind your business for you," he advised. Rumors of the 11th Trungpa doing just that, sometimes on a very intimate level, began to circulate around Boulder. This gets so crazy.
You can see why Ginsberg loved, like, thought this guy was so fucking cool.
He would, like, kiss his feet. Yeah. One of these 3 students, who calls herself Floy Van Den Berg, attended the guru's 34th birthday party in February 1973 and received there a telepathic transmission of thoughts from him, which indicated to her that she should allow a certain man from the Buddhist community to impregnate her. Ignoring the guru's drunken state, she quickly followed his order. Shortly thereafter, the father-to-be obtained an interview with Trungpa, who instructed him to leave for Canada. Floy was told to go on welfare. Before the father left for Canada, Floy, in a fit of rage, dumped a bottle of glue in his hair to symbolize the sticky glue of karma. She was subsequently ostracized by the Boulder Buddhist community, beaten up by several women of the community, and left to shift for herself and her out-of-wedlock child, she claims.
Jeez.
Wow. In her final confrontation with Trungpa, she told him she was leaving his community, but that she would continue to honor the teachings of the Buddha. "They will be of no help to you," Trungpa told her emphatically. "The lions will come to devour you." His ferocity made Floy break down in tears. "No one has been able to hold their own with him," Floy muses today, years after her departure from Trungpa's quote-unquote scene. "People have shown very little ability to think critically or act in a reasonable manner towards the man. They seem to lose a sense of themselves that is capable of functioning at a critical level, and they become emotionally blown out." Floy Van Den Berg appears to feel that this is what happened to her, and that she has not recovered. Floy charges, from personal evidence, that Trungpa became a spiritual stud soon after coming to the U.S. "I personally found that I was punished when I didn't want to go to bed with Trungpa after he asked me to," she says. The punishment apparently comes in the form of psychological rejection. A number of other women students of Trungpa have echoed Floy's testimony on this point. Trungpa's wife, however, told a reporter this year that Trungpa has been a loyal and supportive husband throughout their 10 years of marriage. One middle period Trungpa, remembered by a Boulder citizen, was a guy in a lumberjack shirt who showed up at parties with a shit-eating grin on his face. Nobody knew who he was. I thought he was some drunken Filipino. This really becomes like a who's who of like susness. So where was I? Okay, yeah. He was chain smoking American cigarettes. His wife, Diana, who had given birth to 3 sons between 1969 and 1973, had lately renewed an early interest in riding and was becoming one of Boulder's premier female equestrians. She was later the first woman from America to attend the famous Spanish riding school of Vienna. The Trungpa who founded the Naropa Institute had gone a long way beyond what his old colleague Akang Tolku had regarded as the limits of familiarity with Occidentals and Occidental ways. He expected 800 students to attend his first Naropa summer session in 1974. himself aside, the big attraction of the 11th Trungpa show was Richard Alpert, aka Ram Dass.
Oh, there we go.
The stage guru shootout between Trungpa and Ram Dass, delightfully humorous, Trungpa later called it, attracted nearly 2,000 spiritual journey fans from all parts of the country. So they founded the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, you know, and then there's this Merwin incident that is like a key important thing that happened. So, you know, along with Allen Ginsberg, Trungpa was to discover, would come many poets who would prove far less pliable in behavior and far less respectful of the teachings. Unlike other Naropa faculty members, many Kerouac School poets have showed resentment when their paychecks were loaned back to the Institute without their having been asked. In 1978, Ginsberg's pal, Gregory Corso, took out his resentment against the conservative Naropa administration by trashing his faculty apartment into the summer session. This demonstration of Corso's own brand of crazy wisdom proved to be too much for the administration, which hasn't invited him back. But since 1975, the Kerouac School has been a prime attraction, annually drawing hundreds of students to the Institute. For this reason alone, have its excesses and irregularities been tolerated by Trungpa and the executive officers. The Kerouac School was a prominent feature of the Naropa curriculum in the summer of 1975. Along with co-founders Ginsberg and Waldman, there were at least a half dozen well-known poets on hand, including National Book Award winner W.S. Merwin. Merwin, like Ginsberg and many other poets, was a spiritual yearner who had spent a good deal of time looking for a true way, in his case, in Catholic socialism rather than the disciplines of the East. After the 1975 summer session, Merwin requested permission to attend Trungpa's annual fall Vajra seminary for advanced students. Those who had attended the two previous seminaries had brought back harrowing reports. The only poets who had attended were Ginsberg and his companion, Peter Olofsky, both of whom had practiced meditation previously. Merwin had no experience in the teaching style of tantric Buddhist masters. He asked to bring along his attractive Hawaiian girlfriend, who was equally inexperienced. Going through the tantric teachings, Trungpa has said, is like riding a burning razor. Why then would he admit a pair of uncommitted novices? For reasons that his administrative officers and board of directors still can't explain, Trungpa said yes. William Merwin and Dana Naon paid the $550 fee and joined the seminary group assembling at a remote ski lodge in Snowmass, high in the Colorado Rockies. This is an insane story. From almost the beginning of the seminary, Merwin's presence created a problem. As a pacifist, he first refused to participate at all in prescribed chanting of poems addressed to horrific deities. So did Dana Naon. I later asked Allen Ginsberg to describe these poems. He read several aloud. They had lines like, as night falls, you cut the aorta of the perverter of the teachings, and you enjoy drinking the blood of the ego.
Oh,
an RX straight out of the different book of Dr. Benway. The poems are very un-American, to say the least, Ginsberg didn't have to explain to me. From the point of view of somebody who hasn't been a poet, they're really off the wall. Did they bother you when you were at the seminary? Oh, sure. They bug everybody. They're supposed to. That's what they're there for. Merwin, who'd been a serious peace freak for his entire adult life, couldn't swallow the blood-drinking poems and clammed up when they came up. Later, he was involved in a snowball fight against the Vajra guards and attempted to inspire further insurgency against the master, Trungpa, including a scheme involving zapping the guru with laughing gas. Finally, he aroused Trungpa's Vajra ire by departing early with Dana from a Halloween party which the guru had thrown to inaugurate the dread final month of teachings, in which quote-unquote heavy tantric matters were to be broached. It had been a wild party. Trungpa, who'd arrived late and drunk in jeans and lumberjack shirt, had slipped quickly into something more comfortable, his birthday suit. Born naked on the shoulders of obedient guards, he circled the room in bawdy triumph, ordering the stripping of selected celebrants. Later, he danced with one student who afterwards was left with a souvenir you wouldn't file away with your senior prom corsage, i.e. teeth marks on her face from where he bit her.
What the fuck?
Quote,
wow.
It was very nonverbal, direct, intense, brutal communication, the apparently intelligent young woman recalled. Midway through his party, it came to the guru's attention that his star pupils, Merwin and Dana, had escaped to their room. Bring them down, Trungpa told his guards. They don't want to come, said the guards. Bring them anyway, the master commanded. Break down the door. The guards finally had to smash a plate glass door to gain entry to Merwin's room, making for a Kristallnacht scene that reminded many present of Night Porter, a film the seminarians had seen the week before. The angry poet sliced several guards with broken beer bottles before submitting to being dragged down with Dana to the quote-unquote party, where the drunken Trungpa entertained them with his special brand of heavy comedy. While Merwin and Dana were being fetched, Trungpa had been instructing the other partygoers on exposing your neurosis. He continued the theme when the captives were brought in, accusing them of neurotic violence and aggression. This is like Black Hammer. Like, yeah. When they, it's worse. When they had the gall to argue, the master blew a gasket. He threw a glass of sake in Merwin's face and made a series of racial remarks to Dana that will probably never be recorded in the annals of the Lamas. "We're both Oriental," the guru advised the young woman. "The communists ripped off my country. Only another Oriental can understand that." "You're a Nazi," Dana responded. Wow. Soon thereafter, Trungpa invited Merwin and Dana to take off their clothes. When they refused, he had them both stripped in front of the gaping eyes of a shocked but compliant roomful of seminarians. "Guards dragged me off and pinned me to the floor," Dana Neon recalls. "I could see William struggling a few feet away from me. I fought and called to friends, men and women, whose faces I saw in the crowd, to call the police. No one did. Only one man, Bill King, broke through to where I was lying at Trungpa's feet, shouting, 'Leave her alone and stop it.' Trungpa rose above me from his chair and knocked Bill King down with a punch, swearing at him and ordering that no one interfere. He was dragged away. Richard Asselet was stripping me while others held me down. Trungpa began punching Asselet in the head, urging him to do it faster. The rest of my clothes were torn off. Merwin and Dana stood there. Gorgeous bodies, very beautiful, like Adam and Eve," laughed the woman whose face Trungpa had earlier lunched on. And then, on Merwin's angry challenge, everybody in the room stripped. Trungpa said, "Let's dance." Everybody danced. Merwin and Dana slipped away to their room. The following morning, Trungpa had a letter placed in the seminarian's mailboxes. "You must offer your neuroses as a feast to celebrate your entrance into the Vajra teachings," he told them. "Those of you who wish to leave will not be given a refund, but your karmic debt will continue as the vividness of your memory cannot be forgotten." Merwin and Dana requested an interview with Trungpa. Trungpa urged them to stay on for the tantric teachings. He did not apologize. They stayed on for more teachings, 3 weeks worth. Then, faced with the prospect of another seminary party, hightailed it back to civilization. Presumably, W.S. Merwin will be more careful in selecting his gurus in the future. And Trungpa has definitely been forced as a result of this episode to be a lot more careful about how he conducts himself around Occidentals. But then, that must be an awful strain, since these days, Occidentals are the only people Trungpa ever sees. Yeah, and so this became like a pretty significant scandal that Allen Ginsberg like had to kind of cover up. This is another, you know, just skipping ahead to this chapter here. This is, you know, the last part I'll read. But the original Don Siegel picture had long seemed a perfect allegory to fit the Trungpa story. In mid-December, the new version of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers hit the screen of the Village Theater in Boulder. By New Year's, POD, a new generic term for the local Buddhists, was sweeping through the non-Buddhist segment of Boulder's population. "Do the PODs know what we're up to?" we asked around Boulder monthly. "What are the PODs going to do next?" In early January, I attended a showing of The Rushes of an Italian TV movie that had been filmed at Naropa in the summer of 1978, the summer after Ed Sanders' class prepared his report.
Oh, yeah, Ed Sanders was involved in this?
Yeah. Okay, all right. There was nothing about the Sanders class report in this picture, however. It was a friendly documentary. Now it was being edited by the Trungpa Brain Trust. The viewing room at a pod-controlled movie company office contained some 40 well-scrubbed important pods. At the front row sat Anne Waldman, Allen Ginsberg, and William Burroughs. Their comments, like everyone was above this.
The whole gang.
Yeah. Their comments, particularly those of Ginsberg and Waldman, seemed to be dictating the actual editing of the film. All went happily for an hour or so, with many in-house jokes and much bantering over tea and sake. Then Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, was on the screen, explaining that he was only visiting Naropa because Allen Ginsberg had asked him to come. Allen was his old friend, but really he didn't agree with Buddhist philosophy at all, because Buddhist philosophy said the world wasn't real, which he, Baraka, disagreed with. He said, being a materialist, especially when it came to politics. Cut that, Ginsberg, the producer, was saying. He'd been fussing impatiently during the whole Baraka rap. Now he jumped up, proposing heavy editing of the section of the film. Communism, croaked Burroughs in his ancient Victor Jory voice, is an obsolete philosophy.
Oh, interesting.
Baraka's speech was appropriately mutilated. Wow. The moment of tension had passed. Onto the screen danced the playful, porky little face of the 11th Trungpa, smiling, replying indulgently in his Oxford accent to a question about terrorists in Italy. Yes, politics, it's all part of the material we work with. In January, I overheard Alan talking to some innocent-looking young Naropa students at a party. He was telling them that, yes, it was true that this Merwin thing had taken place, but that individual rights don't apply in a seminary situation. So that Merwin only got what he had coming, and besides, yes, Trungpa was challenging the foundations of American democracy. But that democracy was anyway a failed experiment. The atom bomb proved that. And now what Trungpa was up to was a whole new experiment in monarchy. The students nodded numbly. What was wrong with an experiment in monarchy? I ground my teeth all the way home. Ugh. 2 weeks before Boulder distribution, Xerox copies of the February issue of Harper's were making the rounds. That magazine printed the Naropa diary of Peter Marin, a post-Jonestown conscience victim who now reported his visit to Trungpa school a year and a half earlier. Spiritual obedience was Marin's general subject. He paraphrased parts of the Sanders report, for the first time bringing the Merwin affair to public attention on a national scale. The Boulder camera went to Vajrahatu for comments on the Marin article. Trungpa could not be reached, but his Vajra regent or Dharma heir, Osel Tenzin, aka Robert Rich, son of an Italian golf pro from New Jersey, told the paper that there was no disputing the words in the Sanders class report. They saw what they saw, said Tenzin. Will Trungpa change, the paper asked. Nothing will change, said Tenzin. The practice will be carried out the same way as it has been for 1,000 years. I'm sure that's really traditional. Yeah. A few years later, a strong editorial in the camera attacked Trungpa for his drinking, his limousines, his use of guards. To avoid being called a cult, it might help not to act like one, the editorialist of this normally timid paper wrote. A few months later, the editorial writer confessed to me that attacking Trungpa had been his toughest assignment in 20 years in this business. On January 17th, Boulder Monthly made a formal offer to buy one-time rights to the party at a rate of payment of 10 cents a word. Ed Sanders signed the agreement and returned it on January 30th with a new introduction and a list of corrections to the text. At this point, for the next month, no one except the Boulder Monthly staff, their families, and poets Ed Sanders and Ed Dorn and their families knew the party was about to be published. Allen Ginsberg, for one, certainly did not know, so that when I approached him in January asking him to do an interview about Merwin and poetry and politics and religion, he accepted after expressing only minor reservations, most of which regarded Boulder Monthly. He preferred a more respectable form, such as Playboy. 15 years before, I interviewed Allen for the Paris Review in an effort he now regards as...
Like, stop. Like, you're naming too many CIA publications right now.
Yeah. It was nostalgia.
Like, he had met with John Train to get...
Yeah, exactly. Like, literally, like, it's just a parade of... it was nostalgia about his interview in the Paris Review that ultimately convinced him to go ahead and talk with me despite his reservations. Ed Dorn and I caught up with Allen one cold night. January 12th. Is Ed Dorn related to Bernadine Dorn?
Well, she's married to Bill Ayers, right? Or she was, right?
Yeah, I guess he was. That's just where Chesa one Booty of the Black Mountain from. Poets, his most famous work being Gunslinger. All right, so I guess he's not related that I know of. He was a visiting poet at Kent State University, I guess, but anyway, so I guess no apparent relation. I caught up with Alan one cold night, January 12th, when he was coming out of his Naropa class on the books of Blake. We went with several of Alan's students to the house of Mapleton, which Ginsberg was sharing at the time with two of the Orlovsky brothers, Peter and Julius. While Julius roamed the house, Peter sang and washed dishes, and Alan spoke his mind with careful orchestration of the tape recorder, which he instructed me to turn off or on every few minutes. Alan talked softly and at length about the Merwin affair and its ramifications. With a guru, he said, you make a contract to give up your privacy. 2 hours later, when the tapes were filled, it was with a surprisingly dark and apocalyptic tale. I accuse myself all the time, Alan immediately admitted, of seducing the entire poetry scene and Merwin into this impossible submission to some spiritual dictatorship, which they'll never get out of again and which will ruin American culture forever. Anything might happen. We might get taken over and eaten by the Tibetan monsters. All the horrific hallucinations of the Tibetan Book of the Dead are going to come true right now, in Boulder. The Pandora's box of Bardo Thodo has been opened by the arrival in America of one of the masters of the secrets of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Alan explained succinctly that the end product of the whole Merwin affair and its aftermath had been universal paranoia in the Boulder Buddhist community. But sometimes he had to admit such paranoia is justified. And in the real world, as we know from Guyana, it could be completely justified. some big guru makes a mistake and turns out to have been mad all along. Still, Alan hesitated to criticize his guru, Trungpa. You know, he said, you're talking about my love life, my extremely delicate love life, my relations with my teacher. I asked Alan what, if anything, Trungpa told him about the Merwin story. He said he was trying to explain to Dana that she should respect her roots by taking part in a classical experience of the Orient, which she does come from, Alan reported. What he finally said to me about the whole thing was, this is an opportunity to turn poison into nectar. No sooner had the tapes been turned off than Alan began to fret over certain remarks he made about Merwin, about Trungpa, about Burroughs, about Corso, about Ed Sanders. Alan acts the role of a very worried and weary warrior these days. I took the tapes home and began to transcribe them. Alan left on a trip to New York to receive an award for his poetry. Before leaving, he nervously instructed me to hand over the transcription of our interview to Ann Waldman for an inspection before anything was published. I told him I'd see about that. I had a deadline to meet. Distracted by other affairs, Alan settled for this half agreement, and after another feeble suggestion that we reconsider and send the interview to Playboy, he left town at the end of January. Alan still didn't know Boulder Monthly was about to publish The Party in its March issue. Anyway, yeah. So, yeah.
Allen Ginsberg, once again.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Wait, so was The Party, that wasn't written by Ed Sanders, was it?
Like it,
Ed
was, Sanders, it was. Was he writing something
that was kind of
was like
an expose?
About, it, yeah, it was basically an expose. Okay. Yeah.
Ed Sanders, yeah. Very liminal figure, because it's like he wrote this like kind of exposures of like the Manson family that was like kind of good, like one of the better, like overall in terms of like the narrative it tells versus like Helter Skelter, you know, and then I guess like exposed this very, it's funny that it's like, wow, like it might turn out that like my guru has been like a psychotic fascist all along. And it's like, dude, like he's running around naked, like shit faced, like biting people's faces and like screaming for them. Like it didn't seem like this should be a surprise to anybody. This guy sounds absolutely fucking, this sounds like Reverend Mooned here. Like just bonkers levels of susness, like yeah. Absolute sus. Like I don't know, like it's just so fucking sus.
It's quite insane. Yeah, so it just seems like this guy, like this is just one.
This is like Nexium
story of like his
solo. Yeah. You know, I even all the Italian, like they're screening these like Italian documentaries that were made, and there's like an Italian golf pro, like got, like were they getting like Gladio money? Like what the fuck was even going on? Like I wouldn't put it past these types of people. This guy does sound like, you know, a classic, like even kind of in a way, like worse than the Dalai Lama in terms of just being an unhinged, abusive psycho who like loves monarchy and like dominating people. And that's just kind of scratching the surface. I found it interesting and creepy that, you know, Ginsberg's like talking about his delicate love life. And
yeah,
because like, this is the same period
with his teacher.
Yeah, yeah. And not, maybe there's a thing between them, but like also, you know, this is a period where Ginsberg was, you know, really getting active with a certain type of activism, you know, his NAMBLA advocacy, which he was pretty vocal about in like, you know, the final years of his life in the 80s and the 90s. And also that he like repeatedly wants this like article to be published in Playboy, which I think, you know, Ginsberg viewed as like a safe space for his type of anything concerning him to be published. You know, Hugh Hefner is a guy he could trust going back to like, you know, the early 60s. And it's just, you know, Castle Bank Hugh Hefner, who was probably like doing an Epstein thing at his mansion, blackmailing people, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty sus world that we've stumbled into once again. I just want to bring up
yes.
One other kind of random thing about Harry Smith, and then maybe I guess we can move on. He'd be interesting to like.
Before you do this,
okay,
we
okay.
might. I think we need to clap again. I don't know why. Like, it didn't even notify me, but I like my thing. I don't know when it stopped, but you know, just for the sake of the Garage Band, yeah. Right. I don't, like, you might want to use the Zoom again, but if you,
yeah,
if you want to send it to you, you know, if you want, okay. So we should.
All right,
again.
I'll stop the.
Yeah, I don't know why this is, like, my mic isn't unplugging anymore, but it still fucking did that shit, so I don't know. Anyway, okay. Sorry. So, yeah, what were you
going to
say?
Yeah, yeah, just one more thing I wanted to throw in about Harry Smith. Honestly, he'd be, there's certain things he's, you know, just this, like, Naropa Institute, but other things he was connected to that could be a good kind of episode fodder later down the road. But I just want to read this one thing, because, you know, as the question said, like, his kind of quote about like, my goal was to change the world with music and I succeeded, like, hits different after you've read McGowan. Mm-hmm. And it reminded, I read this one passage from this Brooklyn Rail article about him that reminded me of something that is kind of a minor running theme of just like coincidence noticing in weird scenes, which is that there always seem to be a lot of mysterious fires like happening with like certain people, like in the Laurel. Remember there was like a whole thing about like David Crosby's like house like burned down and somebody said like something was weird that day, like the air was heavy, it just like pure Satanism everywhere or something. It was like really weird, like, and Dave McGowan is kind of like hinting that like something sus or like weird was going on with these, you know, fires. Of course we know about, you know, that daycare center at the Presidio like burning down on I forget, Valpurgis Nacht maybe, or mm-hmm. on the solstice, I forget, destroying all the evidence, etc. But here's a little passage from somebody, I guess Dr. Joe Gross, that I think, I'm not sure if it, there's a book called American Magus that came out some years back.
It's like
that
interviews, is, right? Yeah.
That's kind of the maybe the main source one would use to learn more about this guy. But this is an interesting quote from Dr. Joe Gross talking about Harry Smith. He said, quote, he kept having fires. Wherever he'd be, there'd be a fire. I don't know if he caused them when he was drinking, but he smoked a lot, not just pot, but cigarettes, of course. So at one point, he had been burnt out. His stuff was out in the street, and he was wandering around. And I said, Harry, why don't you just leave the stuff at my office, my apartment? It'll be safe. So he brought some films and books, and I don't know what the heck else. And I put them in the in one of the closets in my office. Then a few weeks afterwards, I went out for some Chinese food and came back within an hour. And when I came back, the street was filled with fire trucks, literally like three or four fire trucks. This was sort of an East Side near Fifth Avenue apartment. And I got to the door, and I said to the doorman, what's happening? He said, oh boy, wait until you get to see your apartment. And I thought he was kidding. I get to my apartment and the whole place was incinerated. And Harry's stuff, of course, had burnt up. The fire started in the closet where his stuff was. It was very mysterious. I couldn't imagine how the fire started there. The only logical thing, if you want to use logic for the illogical, was the possibility that there was a light in the closet and some electrical connection and it burnt up. Harry, strangely enough, took this with great equanimity. I mean, it's almost as if he expected something like that to happen. I can't describe how astonished I was, and chagrined, of course. More of Harry's stuff lost. Anyway, that's life with Harry. It's so, okay, like, that's kind of spooky, I guess. Like, that, a lot of people mention that, like, he often had, like, things of his, like, catch on fire and, like, get destroyed in, like, mm-hmm. weird ways, which I guess maybe if you're doing, like, thelemic rituals, like, you know, over every art object that you make or something. I don't know. Like, I feel like even Crowley would kind of warn about doing, you know, as we've read before, of, you know, kind of telling people, like, don't mess around with Ouija boards. Like, don't do a ritual and then not finish it halfway through, because then you'll summon the Loch Ness Monster, you know? So I don't know. I mean, he was a pretty serious occultist, but at the same time, yeah, I'm trying to think, what the fuck? Very weird. He was like friends with the mice in his apartment, and I guess some of them died, and would keep them in the freezer and call them his mousies.
What?
Yeah.
Someone what died?
This is with Rose Filiou Pettet, who goes by the name of Rosebud. Mm-hmm. She said that he would usually have a parakeet, and it was always named Birdie. And when Birdie would die, it would be wrapped in tinfoil and kept in the freezer. When he lived in the Chelsea at some point, in this very crowded room, he had rigged up a very elaborate amusement park for the mice that were his fellow inhabitants. There were little walkways, there were rope ladders, there were ramps, there were tiny wheels. Food was placed on these things to encourage the mice to come out and amuse him. You'd be sitting in this room talking, and there'd be mice darting up and down the rope ladders and sliding down the ramps and wandering around on the tabletop. And he was very happy with their company because
it was mouse heaven.
It was mouse heaven. He was in mouse heaven, yeah. Folks. Oh my God. Wow. He was very happy with their company because he loved them. And he would usually have an individual, generally a white mouse, who he'd keep as a pet, who would always be called Mousy. And he also had a series of mousies wrapped in tinfoil in the freezer. He loved these things dearly. They were very important to him. He would go on about how they were the only creatures who kept him company in his solitude. When all his friends were gone, Mousy was there. It was very sad. It would make me weep sometimes, and I would promise to be more conscientious in visiting him. I once took him to my parents' home. I announced that I had met the man I wanted to marry, the man that I loved, and I brought home Harry, which is a terrible, terrible surprise. He was drunk and proceeded to locate my mother's cooking sherry and get even more drunk. Then he accused her of being Hitler in disguise. He said he'd seen through her, that he recognized her, and that she couldn't hide herself from his clear vision. She was Hitler. This distressed her more than words can say. Okay. All right. Since we're on this, now here's an interview with Lionel Ziprin. This gets a little even more spooky. He says, well, he had lots of American Indian stuff, but then the spirits came, hundreds of them. Now, how they came about, I don't know. The whole underground, thieves and some that only stole dragons, but only from museums, because they could go through walls. But they were very respectful in the house. I didn't hang out with them. I didn't know who they were. They started graffiti. Where the people died, they graffitied the walls. That was before graffiti appeared outside. They would bring the spirit books in Hebrew, Latin, French, which I have locked in places. Some were written while unconscious on the floor, totally unconscious of what they were writing. Then there was an invasion of the spirits, but they were all connected to Harry. They talked more to me. I don't know how that happened. Well, they talked more to me because Harry would never give them a nickel, laughs. They all wanted a nickel, a bronze Buddha from the 12th century for 20 cents. What did they need it for? Laughs again. So here's the bronze Buddha. I said, the police are going to think I'm a fence. They're going to come in here. We're starving on Avenue D in an apartment, and he's got 4,000, 22,000 dragons, mainly dragons, royal five-clawed dragons, and Buddhas, and Joanne is screaming, and diamonds are rolling on the floor. I said, get this stuff out. The cops are going to come. I'm going away for 20 years. How do I get all this stuff? I said, I don't want it in my house. I don't want all these people in my house. And then, like, parentheses, especially since the captain of the tactical police force, George Mould, became the landlord. What? That is such a surreal. I was reading that and I'm like, this guy seems like insane. Like, what the fuck is like, okay. So he was like, he had spirits just hanging out in his apartment. And I assume he's talking about dragon 4,000, 22,000 dragons. Mainly dragons, royal five-clawed dragons, and Buddhas. Like, are these objects? Really into
I think he's talking about, like, statues, like little statues.
Okay. That's a lot of statues, though, for an apartment.
Well, I mean, like, he's collecting those 000. Ukrainian... Well, I mean, that number might be exaggerated. I don't know.
And they,
it does,
I guess,
also seem like this person's, by, like, you know...
Pazuzus,
yeah.
Basically. He just had an apartment full of Pazuzus that, like, had spirits attached.
I'm looking up
them.
Harry Smith dragons. See if I can find them. Dragon statue? I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, very weird. It almost seems like he's calling the spirits like dragons or something. But
yeah,
also
maybe.
It sounds like he thinks the cops will think
they're gonna arrest them for being like a fence, you know, like selling illegal like antiquities or something.
Yeah. Wow. What the fuck? So this guy was like haunted by like djinn constantly because he was just summoning them. Like, sounds like he had a little bit of a similar arc to Kenneth Anger in that he ended up kind of like old, bitter, and like senile, and like getting sort of like taken advantage of.
His archives
and
collections are now at the Getty Research Institute, so you
yes,
can go
they are.
There. And
yeah,
check them
they
out.
Scooped
yeah.
him up real quick. I bet J. Paul Getty was real keen on that. My God, yeah. So I mean, we just see the whole broader like countercultural sort of networks, like weird. I don't know. Like preoccupations and predilections like really embodied in this guy. And it is interesting that like his weird obsessive like hoarder collection of old records ended up being so, you know, influential on like rock and roll music and the 60s and 70s, and how all these people like kind of revere this dude, and how just like with Kenneth Anger, like he's pretty, it sounds like he's like pretty clear, even though he lies all the time, that his artwork like should be seen as like ritual, basically.
Yeah.
Like a ritual. Like,
oh,
that's
yes.
what.
Yeah.
So it's wild to think explicit. About like this an anthology of American folk music, which some of it has its ooky spooky elements, but there's also gospel music and all kinds of other things. It first arrives to the masses, like mediated through like a hardcore Thelemite who's like trying to do something, like basically instigate a causal change like in society with it. And I mean, he very well could have come up with that idea just kind of on his own and stuff, but I mean, I guess he sold enough of his work to kind of keep going. Like, there was a kind of a, you know, he had supporters, basically. I wonder if the Gettys, like, while he was alive, got into him because they were bankrolling Kenneth Anger. It seems logical that they might kick a few bucks to Harry Smith as well. But I guess he did change it. Is it for the better? Is it for the worse? I don't know. But, well, maybe that bleeds well into question number three, which I can read, because this deals with a somebody who is specifically influenced by Harry Smith's anthology as a young man.
Well, Mitch said a no to love. Well, Mitch said he, I'm just returning from the salt sea, and it's all for the love of thee. Come in, my old true love, and have a seat with me. It's been 3/4 of a long, long year since together we have been. Well, I can't come in or I can't sit down, for I haven't but a moment's time. They say you're married to a house carpenter and your heart will never be mine. Now it's I could have married a king's daughter, dear. I'm sure she'd have married me. But I've forsaken her crowns of gold, and it's all for the love of thee. Now will you forsake your house carpenter and go along with me? I'll take you where the grass grows green on the banks of the deep blue sea. She picked up her little babe and kisses gave it three. Says, stay right here, my darling little babe, and keep your papa company. Well, he hadn't been on ship but about 2 weeks. I'm sure it was not three. Till his true love began to weep and mourn, and he weeped most bitterly. Says, are you weeping for my silver armago? Says, are you weeping for my store? Are you weeping for that house carpenter whose face you'll never see anymore? No, it's I'm not a weeping for your silver armago, or neither for your store. I am weeping for my darling little babe whose face I'll never see anymore. Well, he hadn't been on ship but about 3 weeks. I'm sure it was not 4. Till he sprung a leak in the bottom of the ship and it sunk him for to rise no more.